This is Anya Leonard, the co-founder of Classical Wisdom, a website dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds.
And I'm very happy to say that today we have Dr. David Lewis, lecturer of Greek history and culture at the University of Edinburgh. Thank you so much, David, for joining me today.
Thank you.
So we are going to be talking about ancient bondage, slavery, that is. And would you please start us off by just a little bit of an explanation or description of what slavery looked like in the ancient Greek world?
Sure. So you're dealing with basically a property relationship. So one person owning another person. We find this as early as the Bronze Age. We find it in Homer. We find it in right throughout the classical sources and all the way through the end of antiquity. And unsurprisingly, given the variety of the Greek world in terms of regions, you find a lot of different types there. So the most common type you probably get in, variations of in most places involves the slaves being imported from the periphery of the Greek world. So in the case of Athens is the classic example. They're getting their slaves mainly from two places principally. And one's Thrace, so that's modern Bulgaria and parts of northern Greece. And the other one is Asia Minor, especially central Asia Minor, which is called Phrygia in antiquity. But they also get slaves from all sorts of parts of the Black Sea, from sub-Saharan Africa, a small number. From Syria, quite a large number. And we know about this from all sorts of sources, especially inscriptions. We have some inscriptions from Athens. We've got a great source in Delphi. We have a series of over 1,000 manumission inscriptions, so inscriptions of slaves being freed. And these start around 200 BC and go on through into the first century AD. And quite a large number of cases of those, they tell us where the slave in question came from, their ethnicity. So you can see these slaves being traded through general commercial networks to these city-states from all over the place. And then you get some oddballs like Sparta. And you no doubt have heard of the Spartans' helots. And I should probably own up to having a slightly unconventional interpretation of these. In my favor, it aligns with what the sources say. So these are slaves. The problem with interpreting the status of the helots is really falls in line with the problem of interpreting what's going on in Sparta generally in the classical period, in that we've got sources that disagree with each other that come from different dates. And if you follow the contemporary sources, you get a picture of a slave system. If you pin your faith on the sources from hundreds and hundreds of years later, it looks a little bit different. So I think the safe option is to go for the contemporary sources. So in that case, you've got a very different slave system, though, because it's not topped up from the slave trade. So you're talking about Greeks, enslaved Greek population, and reproducing itself over the generations and living in families. And it's a little bit like the American, the US slave system before the Civil War. The slave trade had been cut off there in 1808, and when the Civil War started, pretty much the entire population had been of slaves had been reproducing itself through slaves living in families, having kids, and actually it grew over time. So Sparta is a little bit of an oddball. There were some other ones like that in the Greek world too. Thessaly in northern Greece had a similar system. And Crete, and we know of some colonial sites like Heraclea on the Black Sea coast that also had a kind of monoglot slave population that seemed to have reproduced itself over time. So there's a lot of variety, matching the variety in the regions of the Greek world in terms of resources, geography, culture, and economic practices.
So how do you feel that? Because there's so many different historians who said they were, you know, one conquered group that didn't pay tribute, and there's many different versions. Do you have one that you prefer?
No, because so the problem with the origin of the Helots is the sources we have are from hundreds and hundreds of years after the events they purport to describe. Basically, it looked like this. In the classical period, there was, in places like Sparta, there was a slave population that reproduced itself, wasn't topped up from the outside, spoke this exactly the same dialect of Greek as his masters. People like Plato and Aristotle come along, and Theopompus of Chios, and Ephorus and other historians, and they go, how did this come about? And the obvious explanation is that the Helots were enslaved in one fell swoop way, way back in the olden days. These rationalizations get mixed in with other rationalizations like the Dorian invasion and these kind of things. Some of them are just completely see-through. So, for example, there's a town at in Laconia, south of Sparta, called Helos. It means swamp town. And in antiquity, there was a kind of etymological explanation that, the Helots got their name because they were from Helos and they were all enslaved, and there you go. Except the etymology doesn't work at all in Greek. The pronunciation of Helot in Greek is very different. So these are really kind of late rationalizations trying to make sense of facts on the ground, and they're not worth putting too much faith in. Now, we can ask where these populations came from, but it's not... probably not worth being overly sanguine about getting an answer that will be uncontested and finish the debate.
Now, in most of the rest of ancient Greece, you could sort of enslave anybody without any problem, but you weren't supposed to enslave another Greek. So how did the ancient Athenians feel about the Spartans enslaving Greeks?
Well, the problem isn't enslaving other Greeks, and the Greeks did this all the time in warfare, enslaving other Greeks. And in somewhere like the Athenians, at least after the time of Solon, so it's the beginning of the 6th century, weren't supposed to enslave free people in Attica, so that wasn't cool. But once you're abroad, it's a different matter, and if there's a war... And actually, if you look at the Delphic manumissions, you can see quite a lot of Greeks in there too. So there's maybe as many Greeks in there as there are Thracians, for example. The predominance overall is for foreigners, but there's a fairly significant proportion of Greeks. So war, piracy, these kinds of processes end up with Greeks being enslaved by other Greeks. And it's kind of a case of hard luck then, from the Greek point of view.
You've written quite extensively on the sort of socioeconomic history of ancient Greece. How do the slave system fit in that sort of perspective of history?
So it's pretty flexible institution, really, and you can adapt it to the situation on the ground in all sorts of different setups. I think just... very, very basically, it's worth saying the slaves didn't do all the work in ancient Greece. Sometimes you get this caricature, and certainly a century ago it was pretty common, of the kind of idle mob of the demos sitting on their behinds while all the slaves did all the work. That's not true. So somewhere like Athens, the leisure class is only 4% of the citizen body in the 4th century. So over 95% of citizens are working most days of their life, working hard. And that leisure class got a significant amount of their wealth from basically buying slaves and then making them do things. So, for example, the orator Demosthenes, we know from his speech number 27 that his dad left him quite a few slaves, over 30 slaves. And then he also left him a kind of sweatshop that was basically... it's what you call an anticredit loan. So Demosthenes' dad lent this guy money, and the guy said, well, you can basically get the revenue from my slave sweatshop instead of interest. So the leisure class, the liturgical class at Athens, basically are making most of their wealth out of slave ownership. And actually, it plumbs much further down the wealth spectrum than that. So probably most citizens could own a slave in Athens, and as a sign of being quite quite poor not to be able to have a single one. So for example, we've got this speech by the orator Lysias, and Lysias 24, and in that speech you've got a guy who's been getting a corn dole from the state because he's disabled, and one of his enemies basically tries to get him kicked off the dole list, and the speech is him trying to defend his right to getting this corn dole. One of the things he says is that I don't have enough money yet to buy a slave to go and do all my work for me. So certainly there's a huge amount of economic parasitism on these imported slaves, but it's not like all the work's done by slaves. In somewhere like Sparta, that's a society where every citizen by default owns slaves, sufficient to let them sit in their behind. So it's like in Athens, the leisure class is 4% of the citizen body. In Sparta, it's 100% of the citizen body. So Sparta's very parasitic on slave labor and completely engineered to almost completely depend on the fruits of slave labor for their lifestyle. So it differs from place to place.
Well, in Sparta, the relationship between the Spartans and the Helots and the potential of rebellion from the Helots from time to time obviously played absolutely instrumental roles in the history of Sparta and the Peloponnesian War. Like, you know, at times the Spartans just couldn't be away for too long because they'd have to worry about the Helots.
I agree with you. Not everyone would, but I think you're right. So, I mean, that particular line was plugged a lot by G.E.M. de Sainte-Croix, who's a historian in Oxford for most of his career, died 20-odd years ago. Met his student, Paul Cartledge. But there's some people who would tone down that view, but I tend to think it's basically correct. So on that issue, at least, I disagree with Cartledge and de Sainte-Croix on the status of the Helots. So, but it's odd for historians to all agree with each other on everything. So.
Oh, and so I guess the next question is, was Athens or Sparta sort of able to accomplish what they did without slavery? I mean, that's obviously an uncomfortable question for people to ask from time to time, but how important was that, working class in the creation of what they were able to accomplish?
That's a difficult question. I think you can treat it on a couple of levels. So that the most obvious one and the one that gets talked about the most often is, like, you know, you can look at architecture like the Erechtheion and the Acropolis, and we actually know the names of some of the slaves that helped build that and so on and so forth. And you can talk about the cultural products of the Athenian upper class or, you know, other Greeks from the upper class, and show that they basically got their leisure, their scholae. They got their leisure from not working because they had slaves to work for them. And that's true. But you can look at it also from the point of view of the what you call the working class Greeks. So if you look at somewhere like Athens, that's a really interesting question because, you know, like I said, not all of these people own slaves. But if you think about the problem in the long term and the evolution of democracy, it certainly took pressure off that particular historical process, but the elite had all these slaves they could exploit for their economic benefit. So the fact that the elite was economically parasitic of slaves rather than directly economically parasitic of people lower down the social spectrum of their same group of the free population probably had a really profound effect in the evolution of class relations over time and the evolution of democracy. It's different from situations you could see maybe in the Middle Ages where you have a landlord basically being economically parasitic of his peasants that are working in his domain. So on the first level, yeah, absolutely. On the second level, people don't talk about that so often. I think that would be an interesting avenue to think a bit more about.
And I guess speaking of the unspoken avenues, I suppose, Do we know much about the life of the slaves? And I mean, I guess there's certain individuals or what their day-to-day life was like. Do we have much insights into that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So, and this is a question people ask me a lot in research at the moment, trying to get a handle on the agency of slaves and that kind of thing. I mean, we know about the lives of certain very prominent ones. So from the orders, we've got good examples of, well, there's a lady, Neaira, Demosthenes 59. And that speech at least purports to give us the outline of this woman's life. Is that she starts off as a child slave in the Peloponnese and then is groomed up by a madam called Nicarete, I think, to work as a hetaira, a courtesan, a prostitute. And we get a lot of details about her life. You know, and you can ask questions about how much of that is true. And then we've got a pretty good amount of information on another quite prominent slave, Passion, who was a banker in Athens and did very well for himself and was manumitted, became the richest guy in town, became an Athenian citizen. So you get these occasional cases of exceptional people, but what about all the other slaves?
Yeah.
And yeah, it's true, most of our evidence is very unrepresentative of them, but sometimes you get the odd bits and pieces that gives you an insight into them. So there was a really interesting document found in the, I think it's from the Athenian Agora and possibly the Kerameikos, but it's a letter written on a strip of lead from the 4th century. And it's from a slave called Lysis, and it's to his mother and this guy called Xenocles. We don't know who Xenocles was. But it's asking them to intercede with his owners. So he's co-owned by, you know, at least two masters, maybe more. And what these masters have done, they put this slave in a foundry, you know, like a blacksmith shop, and he's getting knocked about very badly. And the letter is basically trying to get his mother and the Xenocles guy to talk his masters into taking him out of this foundry and putting him into some other line of work that he won't get as badly abused at. So you occasionally get documents like that. Another genre that's been very interesting in recent years are these oracular lamellae from Dodona in northwestern Greece. So questions to the god there, the shrine. And we've got one at least from a slave called Kitos, and he's asking the god whether his master will basically hold up his side of the bargain and free him like he promised he would. So very occasionally you get these bits of evidence that give you a direct kind of connection to the voice of slaves, but those are the exception rather than the rule.
And were there slaves depending on whether they were owned by individuals state?
Yeah, so the form of slavery we know the most about is, you know, private ownership. Some people would say that the helots were publicly owned. I think that's not true, but that's a debate to look into on another day. But certainly states like Athens had what they called demosioi, so publicly owned slaves, maybe over 1,000 in Athens in the classical period. And these people did all sorts of jobs. And there's a recent book in it by Paul Anismar, which is recently translated into English. It was called Democracy Slaves, and there's plenty of information there on that. But these people were testing coins, working in the archive. Some of them were kind of bouncers that accompanied the magistrates around and did the heavy lifting if there was any need for fisticuffs or anything like that. So, and these are very common in the city-states of the classical period, these state slaves. Another category that's really very understudied is slaves belonging to sanctuaries. And we've got a number of inscriptions from central and northern Greece that show people basically gifting their slaves to sanctuaries, to a god. So they give these people as votives, and then the slave ends up working as part of the staff of the sanctuary. And this raises other questions about, you know, how did this work in practice? Did people treat these people in a specific way because they were the property of a god? All sorts of questions that have been not very well investigated so far. So there's a lot of variety there.
And because the slaves came from so many different places, I guess you just didn't have the same issues with sort of identifying slaves, obviously. I mean, was it clear when somebody was a slave by their skin color or religion or things like that, or did people kind of have a feeling for it?
So there were certain traits that were seen as stereotypical of slaves, like having, you know, facial tattoos or something like that, having red hair. This is something Thracians were supposed to have, red hair, blonde hair, people from the north. But really, you can't tell legal status at sight that easily, because that same person could be manumitted, they could be freed, and they look exactly the same, but they've got a completely different legal status. And we've got this kind of rant by a guy that's known as the old oligarch. He's probably not that old, actually, but he's kind of a right-wing guy. He's very pro-Spartan. He thinks Athens should be run like Sparta, and wouldn't it be better if the Athenian slave system was run like the Spartan system of heritage? And he complains about people not being able to tell the difference in Athens between slaves and free persons. Whereas in Sparta, actually, you can spot a citizen a mile off because they've got very particular habits of dress, and you know, they have a beard but with no mustache, and they have long hair that they're allowed to grow after they come of age. They seem to have particular items of clothing that allow you to pick these guys out in a crowd. So in terms of dress and appearance in Sparta, it kind of encoded legal status in a way that didn't happen in many other places. So it really depends where you are.
And how did the ancient Greek philosophers feel about slavery? Because I know kind of famously about Aristotle versus others, ones maybe can explain some of the opinions of slavery and how they differed throughout the ancient Greek world.
Sure. So I mean, in the early period with the early archaic texts, it's kind of treated like a inevitable bit of bad luck. You know, some people are going to end up being slaves because they've been kidnapped or enslaved in war, and well, that kind of sucks for them, but no one really questions the institution of slavery in the sense of, should we abolish this? It seems not to have occurred to the early Greeks, and therefore whenever it comes to systems of ethics, the sort of behavior you find in Homer, for example, where certain kinds of behavior are encouraged and other kinds are discouraged by examples of certain characters that have these poor character traits coming to a sticky end, that kind of thing. The idea for a slave owner is that the slaves that behave well, you do nice things to them, and the slaves that misbehave, you treat them very badly. And actually, the end of the Odyssey, we find Odysseus and Telemachus basically, I think it's about a dozen slave girls who've decided to sleep with the suitors. Odysseus and Telemachus, who are these admirable characters from the point of view of the poem, and they're meant to be seen as admirable characters. They basically, you know, lynch these 12 slave girls because they slept with the suitors. So, the original audience is supposed to applaud this. Nowadays, you'd have a very different reaction, but the original audience is meant to applaud this. There's another character, Melanthius, who's a disloyal slave of Odysseus. And the whole point, it seems to be, that this guy makes the audience really angry the way he behaves towards other slaves, towards Odysseus in disguise, whom he thinks is just a wandering kind of beggar. And therefore, when Telemachus and actually some of these other slaves get their hands on Melanthius at the end of the Odyssey, they mutilate him and kill him. Again, you're supposed to see this as this guy had that coming. So that's the sort of, and it's a very foreign kind of ethical world to what we're used to now. So, but it's certainly very interesting to try and get your head around that. And later on, like you say, you have deliberate efforts in Book One of Aristotle's Politics, is the most famous, to justify slavery as a natural institution. And the way he goes about that is he basically looks at cognitive competences among people, and he realizes that some people are more intelligent than others, And his theory is that the people who are really unintelligent would be better off if intelligent people enslaved them and made their decisions for them. And therefore, those people are natural slaves, and the people who aren't like that are naturally free. And it's in accordance with nature for the naturally free to enslave the naturally enslaved, the natural slaves.
The irony, of course, being that later on, so many Greek philosophers became slaves to Rome.
Yeah, well, this is a problem Aristotle ran up against, is that reality didn't conform to this kind of abstraction. So he even admits that, you know, in reality, some people who are naturally free and are actually happen to be de facto have been enslaved, and vice versa as well. It's interesting to read that section of the Politics against, we actually have a copy of Aristotle's will. So it's preserved by this guy, Diogenes Laertius, and we know what was in his will. And in his will, he frees some of his slaves. And he said, well, smart guy like Aristotle should have clocked from the outset which of these people were natural slaves and which were naturally free. And he would have never freed the natural slaves, and he would have instantly freed the naturally free people. But he doesn't, and he actually, you can see from his will that he's acting in a way that's very much aligned with what most people did at that time. So he's kind of not practicing what he preaches in Book One of the Politics there.
And he also felt that, women had a different number of teeth than men, so you can't win them all. So Aristotle, yes, very famously believed that some people were naturally slaves, but I think the Stoics were maybe more in accordance with modern beliefs towards slavery.
In certain respects, yes. So there's a good book by Peter Garnsey on ideas of slavery from Aristotle to Augustine, I think is the title, something like that. Kind of wish he'd started with Homer, because that he has very interesting things to say from Aristotle to Augustine. It would be good to kind of dig back a bit further backwards there. But certainly in certain strands of Stoic thought, slavery is seen as a misfortune, and therefore you get in the writings of Seneca, for example, the idea of being sympathetic to the fate of your slave and things like that. But I mean, none of this ever led to any sort of abolition movement in antiquity. So, or someone like Seneca, he might have written about being sympathetic to his slaves, but he still owned a bunch of slaves. So. Again, it's like the Aristotle example. There's theorizing and then actually carrying these things through into practice, and those are two very different things.
So do you feel that their vision on slavery should affect our opinion of them today?
That's a difficult question. So in part, yeah. I think a good way to look at it is that, often when it comes to looking at the Greeks and Romans, people can get very enthusiastic and effusive and be 100% behind them. And whether this is people in Germany in the 19th century who just thought that, you know, the Greeks had just perfected the kind of philosophically perfect version of human life and we should try and get back to that, or even people now who kind of really like the Spartans and think, you know, they call their clubs or whatever Spartans, or even people, Second Amendment activists and so on that are kind of taking on the trappings of the Spartans in a fairly uncomplicated way. I think it's good to look at history and these sorts of details just to come to a more balanced view of the Greeks and Romans. So for sure we could admire some of the stuff they did. I mean, it was really remarkable. If you look at something like the Iliad, I mean, I'm constantly astounded every time I dip into the Iliad to think this thing was actually written in 700 BC or something like that. Remarkable. But when you study things like slavery, you can come to a more balanced view of the ancients and treated in a more subtle way rather than just rather than just using it for your own particular political end.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, the other extreme is also maybe don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, like just because Newton was an alchemist doesn't mean that he didn't have a good thing to say about gravity as well. You know, you gotta be more balanced.
For sure, absolutely. So, and it's a very human thing in that, you know, what if we're still, if our species is still around, you know, the times of our grandchildren or great grandchildren, they'll probably be appalled that we ever got on a plane or ate meat or used single use plastic. But a lot of these things people didn't cotton on to till quite a lot of agitation pointed out the problem. And it's the same event for any historical society. And it's extremely easy and seductive to kind of wag the finger at the dead for not being as woke as we all are supposed to be now, but it's more complicated than that. And I think studying these uncomfortable aspects of antiquity can lead you to a more nuanced appreciation of the problem rather than being like 100% and just throwing these people out because they did something terrible, or the alternative, which is just not looking at the bad things they did do. So.
Yeah, it's a more critical view of history to sort of get a fuller picture of humanity, I think.
Sure.
To finish up, can you give me a little insight on what you're working on right now?
Yeah, so I'm still working on a couple of things to do with slavery, but I'm mostly reorienting towards looking at labor in general, but in the city of Athens and down in Piraeus during the classical period under the democracy. And so if you think, a lot of people poured a huge amount of effort into studying the democracy, the political institutions, the leadership, friends, so on and so forth, the dynamics of the democracy, but it's amazing how little work's been done on the actual life of the demos in the city. And these people had a disproportionate influence on the assembly, because, you know, if you're a small farmer out in Marathon, you know, it's a long way to come to the city to sit in the assembly and take part in that aspect of the democracy. Whereas if you're a craftsman in the city, and you're getting paid to go to the assembly at a certain point, it's no problem. So these people had an advantage in terms of participation over people who are a bit further out in Attica, which is quite a large territory by ancient Greek standards. So it would be good to know a lot more about what the lifestyles of people working in the city, in crafts and retail and service occupations and things like that, was like. And there's been, in the 1980s and 1990s, there was a huge orientation towards looking at the Greek countryside, survey archaeology, looking at the grain trade and how important it was and that kind of thing. And now on the Roman side, there's a lot more work being done on urban economies. And there's an opportunity for people working on the Greek side to catch up and start to collate all this information together and also synthesize it with archaeological findings and build up a really rich picture of how that urban economy functioned. And therefore, that can be linked into the political side as a sort of organic whole. So that's what I'm doing next. And there's a lot of work ahead of me.
Well, it sounds very interesting. And I'll put down some links of the books that you referenced and any of the other projects that you're working on below. And thank you again for speaking with me today. I think I've learned considerably more about ancient slavery.
Ah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.